Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT podcast. In fact, what you're going to hear is a live recorded MCRIT podcast from my ED Critical Care Conference 2015, which was phenomenal. Over the coming months, you will hear other lectures from the conference, and I think you will love them. Today, the live podcast will be on a case. It is not a real case. It is an imaginary case. It is based on many cases I have seen, and it brings up some points that are really important to me, and I want to know what you think. So after listening to this podcast, please come and comment on the MCRIT site. In addition, there's a lot of concepts mentioned very quickly. All of them are linked in the show notes at mcrit.org/141. That's mcrit.org/141. That's the number of this podcast. So come on over and you'll find all the references and links to everything we talk about. Let's get to it. This is going to be a live MCRIT podcast. This is going up on the podcast on Monday, as long as I don't screw it up too much. And so that's what we're going to talk about. And we're going to talk about a case. And it's an imaginary case at an imaginary hospital. It's a case that takes place at Janus General, a hospital I created in my own mind and put up on the web so that I could host these imaginary cases and not get fired. So, you have a 45-year-old male with sarcoid complaining of severe shortness of breath. And the pulse rate is 128, blood pressure 70 over 40, saturation 72% on a non-rebreather mask, temperature 102 Fahrenheit. The patient looks bad. You get an x-ray. The left lung is entirely gone to consolidation, and the right lung looks pretty crappy as well, probably from the patient's underlying lung disease. And what comes to mind is that you will intubate this patient. There's no doubt in your mind that the patient needs intubation. But a lot of things are going against you. The patient has some of the HOP killers, and you remember what HOP stands for. It's the acronym for the things that make an airway physiologically difficult. And it stands for hemodynamic problems. Patient is already in shock, and now you're going to come and put them on positive pressure. Oxygenation problems, intubating the patient who's already saturating poorly. And then pH problems. The patient is severely acidotic, who, if you screw up their ventilation, may get worse and code. And unfortunately, you know this patient has one of them. They have the oxygenation problems, and they almost certainly have physiologic shunt. You look at that x-ray with no left lobe, and you know blood is circulating through alveoli that are not being oxygenated. The patient has physiologic shunt. And you remember what that is, right? Normal alveoli, oxygen comes in on the venous side, 70% sat, gets oxygenated, goes out at 100. Shunted alveoli, whether it be from fluid or pus or atelectasis, goes in at 70, comes out at 70. And all the oxygen in the world doesn't make that better. This patient certainly has that. But it's worse because the patient has another of the HOP killers. This patient has poor cardiac output. They are already demonstrating that they're in septic shock. They're hypotensive, and this patient's cardiac output is poor. And when you have a poor cardiac output, and Oren mentioned this just a couple minutes ago, your venous side has a lower than normal oxygen saturation, and that's what's coming into the lungs. Now, a normal patient, 70% on the venous side. But in a shunted patient, patient who has poor cardiac output with low SVO2, it could be 50% on the venous side. Now, you combine those two. You combine a physiologic shunt and a low SVO2, and instead of what comes through from the venous to the arterial side of 70% or somewhere thereabouts, now we're talking 50% is what's going through the physiologic shunt and coming to the arterial side. That's a really, really bad situation. When you combine poor cardiac output and physiologic shunt, these patients have a really high predilection for dying on you. So you have two out of the three of the HOP killers, and you're already scared. So you're going to try to ameliorate as much of this problem as possible before you intubate. So you put the patient on non-invasive ventilation. You put them on CPAP. You give them a nasal cannula at 15 liters per minute to maximize their FiO2. You start pressure bagging in fluids because you know this patient is going to need fluid with a septic shock state. You give antibiotics earlier the better once they hit septic shock. But you know the fluids are not going to be enough. Even in a big IV, it takes a while for a significant amount of fluid to go in, and you need to intubate this patient soon. So you start the patient up on a vasopressor drip. You start them up on norepinephrine. You do it peripherally. You don't need to waste time on a central line right now. You can do that after the patient settles. You start your norepinephrine peripherally, and you aim for a MAP that gives you a little leeway so that when you intubate and they drop, they're still not at a critical point of low blood pressure where they're going to have an arrest. And you draw a push-dose epinephrine, so you have another backup plan, so if the patient does drop as you're intubating them, you can immediately respond and not have to worry about figuring out what the next dose range is of that norepinephrine. You know if you push 1 or 2 cc's of this drug that the patient's going to get a hit of inotrope and vasopressor support. And then as you're getting ready to intubate, you use a checklist, because you know the sicker the patient, the more rapidly you need to proceed with that intubation, the more important it is to make sure everything's done right, and the more likely your brain is going to be burdened and you're going to forget things. So you checklist these intubations. And you're not going to go through the whole checklist out loud, but you stress a few points. You verbalize your failed airway plan so that everyone in the room knows exactly what the sequence of events is going to be, and so that they could stop you from deviating from your own plan when you decide you're going to try laryngoscopy an extra 8 times because you really think you're going to get it this round. And so now everyone in the room is on the same page and they know what's going to happen next. And the failed airway plan that you verbalize is the shock trauma difficult airway algorithm, because to your mind, it's the only one that's actually been looked at in the literature and has any validation at all. And the algorithm is really easy to say out loud. Simplest thing in the world. We're going to do 3 attempts at laryngoscopy. If that fails, we're going to place a supraglottic airway. And if that does not sufficiently oxygenate the patient, then we will move on to a surgical airway. And you say that out loud, and everyone in the room knows what's going to happen. You make sure your equipment is just right. And one of the things you really stress is the properly set up bag valve mask. And so there's your BVM, and it's not enough to just have that hooked up to oxygen, though you certainly verify that's the case. But you go further now, and you know this patient's requiring positive pressure for their pre-oxygenation. So if you needed to bag the patient, they'll certainly need that same degree of CPAP. So you put a PEEP valve on, and you set it to exactly what it takes to get this patient pre-oxygenated. But you go further, and you do what they do in the operating room. You don't hope and pray that your breaths are going in when you use that BVM. You put end-tidal CO2 on the BVM itself so that every breath you deliver gives immediate feedback that it went in. As the patient expires passively, you see the beautiful spike of end-tidal CO2, and you know you're doing the job properly. Now, this bag has one additional function that you're very happy with, which is it actually has a pressure gauge on it, so you know your breaths are less than 30 centimeters of water, preferably less than 20, because 22, 23 is where your lower esophageal sphincter pops open. And you know that when the adrenaline surge hits your hands, you're probably going to be bagging at 100 centimeters of water. And once the patient pukes, it all goes downhill and things start getting really, really bad. But you know as long as you stay in the green zone, or at the worst in the yellow zone on this BVM, you're going to be giving perfectly pressure-oriented breaths. You go further on your equipment list, and you make sure you have a video laryngoscope. The video laryngoscope you use allows you to do both direct and video-assisted laryngoscopy. It's a standard geometry blade, which means you could use that for every single intubation you do and have the automatic backup of the screen already present at the bedside. You get all your intubation equipment gathered and ready. So there's your video laryngoscope, and here's your intubation equipment. And you don't gather it de novo for each intubation, because that's not time sensitive for patients like this. That's not a good use of your time. You have it already pre-checked, and you have it in a dump kit, just like they use on the helicopter ambulances, because this has been battle-tested in the field where things are really bad and they don't control their environment. So why not bring that same technology to the bedside? And on the green side, you have everything you need for standard laryngoscopy. And you have a backup laryngoscope to your video, and you have your oral airways and they're there. And you have your intubation checklist ready to go, sitting there for every intubation. And if you flip over to the yellow side, all the equipment to enact your failed airway plan is already there, laid out for you. Your supraglottic airways, your bougies, and your scalpels. And you know, since you checked it yourself, that everything's ready to go.
You choose your meds. You're going to use low-dose ketamine because this patient's hemodynamically unstable. And because their cardiac output is poor, you're going to use high-dose paralytic because it's going to take longer to work otherwise. So you're going to maximize the benefit of these drugs for your patient's situation. Your resident takes the first attempt at laryngoscopy, and he does a fantastic job. But all he could visualize, even with external laryngeal manipulation, which you provide, since you're using video, you could actually offload that skill to your partner because they're able to see exactly what you see. And with maximal external laryngeal manipulation, thyroid manipulation, you still are only able to achieve a grade 3 view. And for the real airway gurus in the audience, it's actually a 3B, meaning the only thing you see is epiglottis. No piece or portion of the glottic structures at all. You have a grade 3 view. A 3B view is associated with a 70 to 80% incidence of difficult airway. And unfortunately, that's how this intubation progressed. So the resident very appropriately attempts a blind passage of the bougie directly under the epiglottis, hoping that coup de tip will direct it into the glottic passage. And you place a tube over it, and you give the first breath, and there's no end-tidal CO2. So you immediately pull that tube and reoxygenate the patient. The SATA dropped to 50% in the 20 to 30 second span of your attempting that intubation. And so you bag the patient with that PEEP valve and with end-tidal CO2 guaranteeing each breath is going in. And after 3 minutes, you can only get the SAT up maximally to 82%. And now you say, that I have no choice. And now you yourself are going to take this second attempt. This is not a trainee intubation anymore. This is getting real. So you try and you get the exact same view your resident did. Can't do any better, even with your own external laryngeal manipulation. So you take that bougie again and you watch it slide underneath the epiglottis. It's touching the epiglottis. There's no reason it shouldn't go and through the cords. But this time you actually check holdup, meaning you keep advancing that bougie. And if you're in the right place, if you're in the bronchotracheal tree, it should get holdup. It should stop because as you pass the carina and get to some of the smaller branches, the bougie doesn't go any further. And in this case, the bougie keeps going, and you're just basically pushing it down the esophagus. So you don't even bother putting a tube in. You take the bougie out, and you reoxygenate the patient. And now, SAT is 40%. So you start bagging again, and each breath is confirmed with your end-tidal CO2. And after 3 to 4 minutes of bagging with PEEP, SAT can only come up to 78%. All right. You get one more shot at it. And this time, you've got to do something differently each time, so you've made the decision that you're going to take that Macintosh blade and use it as a miller. You actually are going to lift up the epiglottis with it and hope that that's going to reveal the glottis and allow you to put the bougie in. And so you start your third attempt, and you put the blade in, and everyone in the room tells you the SAT has already dropped before you even make your attempt. The patient desaturates immediately down to 42%. You now declare, because you've already verbalized your failed airway plan, that this is now a failed airway, and you're not going to go further with attempts at laryngoscopy. And if you tried, hopefully everyone in the room would tackle you and take that laryngoscope out of your hand. So you've declared it, and you know the next step on your algorithm is to place a supraglottic airway. So you take an LMA, you lube it up, and you put it in. It slides in very nicely. You inflate the cuff, and you start bagging with your bag with end-tidal CO2 and PEEP on it. And with each breath, you get perfect end-tidal CO2. The supraglottic is perfectly placed. Each breath gives a beautiful waveform, and you're feeling better about this now because this should work out well. And you actually call anesthesia to the bedside to bring a fiber optic scope because hopefully now that you'll reoxygenate the patient through your supraglottic, they'll be able to just pass the fiber optic scope through and intubate through your supraglottic because this is not a patient you want to take out the supraglottic and let any further attempts. So you're feeling pretty good for about 10 seconds until you realize, despite your perfect breaths, despite the PEEP, the SAT is not moving from 50% with a good waveform. And so you bag a little more because you know they're going in. This patient should recover. Maybe it's just pulse ox lag. Maybe it's taken a while due to the patient's poor cardiac output to reflect your rescue breaths. But there's no improvement. And so you bag a little bit more, and there's no improvement. SAT still 50%. And now you're kind of miserable. Because you know what has to happen next, and you don't want it to. You don't want to cut this patient's neck. This is not the case where you're going to, you know, feel great about performing a surgical airway. This is not the patient with vomit or blood in their airway, and you know that that has to take place because there's no other choice, and you don't want to, and you keep looking up at the SAT hoping It's going to finally start rising because there's no reason it shouldn't, but it doesn't. And now you get to the hardest part of a surgical airway, which is making the decision. So you start feeling for the structures and you feel nothing. You can't feel any cartilage. You can't feel thyroid. You can't feel cricoid. Nice long neck, but you can't feel any of the structures. Turns out the patient had had radiation therapy for thyroid cancer. You found this out later. All right, so now you have really no choice. And so you make a big cut. You make a 3-4 centimeter incision at the lower portion of the neck because you want to stay away from anywhere around the cords. And so you make your cut, and it starts bleeding. And they always bleed. Every single time you've performed a surgical airway, they bleed. But they usually don't bleed like this. And it's not arterial bleeding, but it's just a welling up of venous blood far in excess of what you've seen in your previous surgical airways. And it turns out the patient was on dabigatran. He didn't bother mentioning that in his med list, but so there you go. And so now you have to make your second cut, but you get your finger in there and you can't really feel very much at all. And so you pick a spot that you know is low enough that you're not going to be at or above the cords. And you do what the ENT surgeons refer to as cutting to air, which means you put your scalpel in, and if you get air popping out of that hole, you know you're in the right place. And if you don't, then you cut again until you find air. And this is what you wind up doing sometimes. So you cut to air on this patient, and with your first cut, you get sprayed in the face with a beautiful burst of air laden with blood, and it's the best thing that happens because you're wearing eye protection because you'd never do a surgical airway without that. And as soon as that happens, you know you've accessed the airway and you feel better about things now. And so you place a bougie into the hole and you get hold up this time. It stops and you know you're in the right place. And so you've got the bougie in there, you're starting to feel good, and you ask for a trach. And so they hand you one and there's no cuff on the trach. And you know this patient will die because it's not your typical case where all they need is to be ventilated. This patient needs real airway pressures. So you notice there's a Melker kit in your airway box, and so you get that. And you've never seen this before, but it's an uncuffed Melker. So that's not going to help. So you grab what is the industry standard, which every textbook says you should do, which is you just grab a small endotracheal tube and you put it in, you sink it till the cuff just disappears through your hole, and you bag through it, and you have end-tidal CO2. And you're feeling a little bit better about things now. Sat's still 52%. And so you dial up the PEEP on the PEEP valve, you knock it up to 20, sat's still 52%, beautiful waveform. Finally, you put them on the ventilator, and you knock the PEEP up to 30. And after about 5 minutes, the patient's sats finally start coming up. And after about 15 minutes, you're able to dial that PEEP down. You get the patient down to a PEEP of 16, and you're feeling a little bit better about everything. Still an unstable airway. You still have a tube sticking out of the middle of the throat, and you're not so happy with that. So you call anesthesia, and you ask him again, could you fiber optically intubate from above? And we'll consider, you know, if you can, whether it's a good idea to exchange that tube. And anesthesia, they don't bring the fiber optic. They bring another videoscope. They look. They say, this view is crap, the exact same view you got. We're not going to mess with this. All right, that's fine. So you page ENT, and ENT comes in from home. Very nice. They say, you did a fantastic job, but we don't want to take this patient to the operating room tonight. We could trach them in the morning. I think they're stable enough for tonight. Okay, so you talk to your critical care colleagues, and you get a bed upstairs, and you discuss keeping the patient heavily sedated. You discuss paralyzing the patient so that there's no movement at all, and that you think if they get trached in the morning, that ET tube should be okay. And you go home, and you don't feel good about what happened. You don't feel like this was a win. And what you realize as you agonize and don't sleep is that there's 100 things you could have tried. There's all these different techniques. Should we use the straight blade? Should we use a glide scope? And what you realize is none of these are relevant in a patient with poor saturations and in a rapid desaturation. You have to just stick with what you do best. And all the little tricks and games are for a patient that is saturating well, and you have time to try new things. But otherwise, they're not really relevant. And if you didn't cut the neck, the patient would have coded and probably would have died. And so you go to your next shift, where you receive an email saying that you're being written up because you placed an unstable airway in a patient. And you sent them up to the ICU that way, and you should have put a trach in. And then you get another email questioning whether a surgical airway was indicated in this patient, and why couldn't you intubate? And you feel bad. And at some level, you realize that feeling makes it less likely that you'll perform a surgical airway next time, even if it's only at a subconscious level. And and that's really why I wanted to talk about this on the podcast, is I think we're doing ourselves in on surgical airways. Study of airway out there was probably in the National Audit Project in Great Britain, and the NAP4 actually looked at why patients die in critical care intubations, ED and intensive care units. And one of the main things that came out of that study is that people were reluctant to perform surgical airway and waited too long to perform surgical airway. And they went further, and they gave this quote: in appropriate circumstances, prophylactic cricothyrotomy has numerous advantages, not the least the potential to secure and check the rescue airway in a calm and unhurried manner without hypoxia before an emergency arises. They're going further to say, in some patients who you have reasonable saturations on that supraglottic, you shouldn't wait for them to die before you move to surgical airway. That might be the right time to perform a surgical airway. A patient who you're bagging after 3 failed attempts, you could get up to a 95% sat, and you say to yourself, wow, they have upper airway distortion, there's something wrong up here, maybe this is the time to perform surgical airway. They go further than just validating the time we absolutely must to say we might even do it earlier. If you manage airways, you must be able to perform a surgical airway. You must have the will, the knowledge, and the equipment to do it every time you pick up a laryngoscope. Cutting the neck during an emergency airway is psychologically tough enough. And I want to ask you, are we making it even tougher? We're not doing enough surgical airways. We're waiting too long to do them, and our attitude towards them makes them less likely to get done. Scalpel finger bougie, surgical airway saves lives. I get an email from someone who's listened to the podcast, they've watched the videos, and they say, it was these videos that allowed me to rescue this failed airway with a surgical airway. This can save lives. We need to do this. This is now a dying skill. Some people go their entire careers without performing a surgical airway. And that's great if it's because you managed every one of the airways perfectly in your career. But if you had a single patient code as a result of not being able to get a tube, if you had a patient who got critical desaturation and neurologic damage as a result of waiting too long before you finally did get that tube, then that's not good. We must be trained, ready, and willing to perform surgical airway. And with that, I thank you so much for your attention.